Evening, family. Yes, I could not escape the pun. It just kept popping up and as I was writing everything down, and I thought, okay, we'll just roll with it. Some people will appreciate it, others will not. And for those that don't, I'm not sorry at all about this. Again, want to encourage everybody that wants to come out to the house tonight after our time together is over to just sit and visit with Nathan and Bailey. We got coffee. We got popcorn. That's really all you need in this life. So if you think you need something else, that's on you. So, okay, we're continuing looking at a pleasing faith from Hebrews chapter 11, looking at the characters in that chapter and the character that they display in how they are working under their faith. And before we begin, I want to just lay some ground rules for us. Everyone, yes, that includes you, has ingrained assumptions about every situation. Every situation. And that means that what that so-called common knowledge is may actually be wrong. Okay? For instance, in the Middle Ages, I'm going to give you the definition of astronomy from the Middle Ages. Astronomy is the study of how the heavenly bodies move around the earth. That was common knowledge. Everybody knew that everything rotated around the earth at that point. Problem? Wrong. The heavenly bodies don't rotate around the earth. This is part of mankind's problem, is that we tend to think that the heavenly bodies rotate around us. And so we applied that to the earth back then. Here's a Bible-based assumption that is often taken. I'm going to ask a question, answer it to yourself in your mind. What was the fruit that Adam and Eve ate in the garden that God told them they couldn't? How many of us thought of an apple first thing and then had to correct ourselves as we were thinking it? Now you're thinking that they ate an apple, aren't you? But that's a basic assumption that a lot of people make from the scriptures, right? Bible doesn't tell us what the fruit was that they ate, but legend and art and the Latin language have led us to that conclusion. So tonight I want to challenge another assumption in our study of how faith is manifested by the people of chapter 11. And we're going to actually begin in Genesis chapter 4 and verse 5. So if you'll turn over there. It's kind of fun when you request people to turn to Genesis because everybody knows where that book is and it's just they can get there quick. Genesis chapter 4, starting in verse 1. Now the man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. Again, she gave birth to his brother Abel. And Abel was the keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering. But for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard. So Cain became very angry and his countenance fell. And for those of us that are familiar with the story, we know what the countenance falling of Cain led to, which was the murder of Abel, which we're not going to get into tonight. But here's the assumption I want to challenge tonight. Often the assumption is made, and this is still being made by scholars and people who have written thousands and thousands of words on what the Bible actually means. But one assumption that is made is the reason that God looked favorably on Abel's sacrifice or Abel's worship, which is what we're going to be talking about tonight, Abel's worship was because it was an animal and Cain's was not. And that's an assumption. There's a couple of issues I take with the assumption. First, we don't know what God told them to bring. We're not told that anywhere up to this point in the Bible, and we're only four chapters in at this point, okay? Secondly, the assumption that is often made that God had regard for Abel's sacrifice over Cain's because it was an animal is often referred to the law of Moses, which is not going to be given for another 2,500 years and also included grain offerings. So let's be consistent in our thought process here as we are approaching what is going on. And so the more I look at this and the more I study this out, the more convinced I am that the reason God looked favorably on Abel's offering is because of the faith which motivated him to bring it. Now, you might think, wow, Jeremy, that's some very deep study that you've done there, considering Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 4 says, by faith, Abel offered a better sacrifice to God. Right? And that he obtained a testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. But you go to Psalm 40 that Nathan read for us tonight, and there's other aspects in the scriptures that start to present a much larger picture as we're looking at it, especially in verses 6 through 8 of Psalm 40, where the psalmist says, sacrifice and meal offering you have not desired. My ears you have opened, burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. Then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book, it is written of me, I delight, and here's where I want us to pay attention. I delight to do your will, O God, your law is within my heart. This whole idea of what God wants doesn't always match with what we assume. And in the case of Abel, we need to be very careful about the assumptions that we make and what he is bringing. But I can say for certain that Abel's sacrifice was, the Lord looked favorably on Abel's sacrifice because of his faith. Not because it was an animal. Not because that, you know, he was looking down his religious nose at Cain as they were bringing the offering forward, but it was the faith by which is manifested in this offering and all of that. And I'm not so sure of the timeline for Genesis chapter 4 when you go back and you start trying to piece things together chronologically, but we do know a couple of things. All we know for certain is that this happens after mankind is expelled from the garden, where Abel and Cain are bringing their offering to the Lord, and this is after Adam and Eve have been expelled from the garden. And I think assumptions can be educated or uneducated, right? An educated assumption that we can make is that Adam and Eve were at least teaching their children something. And I think that it had to do with God, especially when you look at verse 1 of the chapter. When Eve is pregnant, she gives birth to Cain, she says, I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. So it would at least appear from Eve's perspective that that whole garden thing and the not apple fruit that they ate, she's learned the lesson from. Okay, so there's at least God being presented in the story outside of the garden. So I'm making an assumption that Adam and Eve told their kids why they had to work so hard and why they weren't living in the garden anymore. And I think that it's a good assumption. Otherwise, why would Abel and Cain bring offerings? I'd see no reason for an offering if they were living in ignorance about what happened in the garden. So, think about this for a second. You are Adam or Eve, and you have children, and you were living in paradise, and now you're not. How would you communicate that to your children? It's pretty personal, right? What would you tell them about what had happened in the garden? Did Cain and Abel actually see the flaming sword that kept them from re-entering the garden? I have that question too. It's not answerable. How would you communicate that story? I think it would be a very personal story. And if it was me and I put myself in that position, I would want to communicate to my children, okay, here's the deal, guys. A while back, since we don't know how long they were in the garden or how long after the garden this happens, a while back, your mom and I, well, we thought we were smarter than God. And your mom had this talking snake yakking in her ear. And he wasn't very bright either. And he got what was coming to him, but we'll talk about him in a minute. Let's just deal with what happened between me and your mom. And we ate this fruit that was hanging off of a tree that God had said we could eat anything we wanted in the whole garden, except from that one tree. And guess what we did? We ate of that one tree. Our eyes were opened. We realized that we had made a huge mistake and sin against God. And so we tried to cover it up ourselves, and we hid ourselves from God during that time period. But God found us. He always finds us. Can't hide from him. And so God had a conversation with us. I can't even say that it was me talking and having a conversation with God. I answered a few questions. I tried to lay the blame on him and Eve, but he wasn't having any of that. And so he cursed us because of my sin. And I should have died that day, but he was gracious, and he let me live. I have to live with the consequences, and now, son, you have to live with the consequences also because of my sin. But God was gracious enough to clothe me properly, to show me what I should have been doing, and give me that mercy when I desperately needed it. And do we realize that Abel and Cain are the first generation to live outside the garden? I don't know if we think about that very often, right? We're just like, oh, it's Cain and Abel. One of them lives, one of them dies. Spoiler alert. This is the first generation to live outside of the garden that God had meticulously built and planned for mankind to live in. I think that Abel would have a very intimate knowledge of how gracious God had been to his parents. I think he'd be looking at it as, yeah, sure, the work is more difficult, but, man, God continues to provide all that we need. Abel would know for certainty that he didn't cause the sheep to come into existence. He would know for certain that he didn't cause the grass that the sheep eat to come into existence. He didn't see creation. He didn't see any of that happen. He didn't even see the sin that his parents had committed in the garden. And this is where faith comes in. Because just because he didn't see the creation, he's living with the evidence. And just because he didn't see his mom and dad's sin, he is living with the consequences of it, as well as God's grace and the knowledge of God's grace during this time period. And that is the faith that Abel brings to the worship. It is the conviction of things hoped for, the assurance of things not seen, this idea of what faith is. And so you have to ask the question, what did Abel not see? He didn't see these things happen, but yet still brought the worship. And I've said before that, and it was last year in our study of corporate worship, that worship is one of the ways that God helps us and prepares us for the reality of the world that we're going out into. Right? It builds us up and encourages us for that. But that's not the only reason for worship. I think that another reason for worship is that it is also the way that we acknowledge not the reality of the world that's out there, but the reality of what's going on in our own lives. Right? What sin had done to us, and how gracious God has been. Well, who has the greatest experience on the face of this earth to offer worship with the knowledge of what sin had done and how gracious God had been if it wasn't Abel? Adam and Eve, maybe. Turn to Psalm 85. Psalm 85. We're going to read the whole psalm. Psalmist writes, O Lord, you showed favor to your land. You restored the captivity of Jacob. You forgave the iniquity of your people. You covered all their sin. You withdrew all your fury. You turned away from your burning anger. Restore us, O God of our salvation, and cause your indignation toward us to cease. Will you be angry with us forever? Will you prolong your anger to all generations? Will you not yourself revive us again that your people may rejoice in you? Show us your loving kindness, O Lord, and grant us your salvation. I will hear what God the Lord will say, for he will speak peace to his people, to his godly ones. But let them not turn back to folly. Surely his salvation is near to those who fear him, that glory may dwell in our land. Loving kindness and truth have met together. Righteousness and peace have kissed each other. Truth springs from the earth, and righteousness looks down from heaven. Indeed, the Lord will give what is good, and our land will yield its produce. Righteousness will go before him and will make his footsteps into a way. Could this not have been said by Abel when he was presenting his offering to the Lord? Could this not be said by us when we present our worship to the Lord? Sin in the garden, sin in our lives brought about the same result, death. Yet, the psalmist says that God showed favor in verse 1, that he restored, that he forgave, that he covered sin, that he withdrew his anger, that he restored. And because God did all of these things, we, along with the psalmist, and I'm convinced Abel and the heart and faith that he brings to the worship here, cry out, keep us from returning to being stupid. Let us not return to folly that had put us in the position in the first place. And we stake our lives on that reality. That's our hope. Even though we didn't see Jesus and what he accomplished, we live with the conviction. So by faith, Abel offers a better sacrifice, better worship. And the ending of that verse says, and through faith, that would be Abel's faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. So, Abel pleased God in his approach. He acknowledged who God is, and I'm convinced what God had accomplished for him, for his brother, for his parents, for all of the mankind living outside of the garden at that point. And it's that faith that when God saw it, pleased him. It was that faith that God said, that guy's got it. He's got it figured out. And he looked on that sacrifice, he looked on that worship with regard. Cain's he did not, because I'm convinced Cain did not present it with that kind of faith. And worship motivated by faith is what God is looking for, even today. Even today. Worship that claims complete dependence on him. And it's a worship, guys, that produces joy. Because it's not found in what we can do, but founded in what God has done in his strength, in his power. And it gives us this security to face reality. No wonder we should want to do this as often as we can. To present to God a pleasing sacrifice, to present to him a pleasing worship that is based on faith in him and him alone. That is able-bodied worship. Let's be encouraged by the stories that we read in the Old Testament and in the New Testament. Let's be encouraged by the real people that we get to experience and the life that they live. Abel's story was very short, but yet we're still talking about it all these years later. That it was important enough for God to bring it up again. All these years later. And let's learn from Abel. Let's not struggle in our worship to God. But by faith recognize what he has done for us. And we are to be a people that believe that and live by it. That's our conviction. We didn't see it happen. But we are living with the evidence and the consequence. Be encouraged this week to be a people of faith. We're going to stand and sing the song Dan has prepared for us. Let's be encouraged even more. As we sing this song, as we stand before the God who is the supreme power in the universe, who though has the absolute right to strike us dead the moment that we sin, is gracious to us when we seek it. Seek his grace. Seek his mercy. And if you're ready to have your sins washed away in baptism. Now is the time. If you need the prayers of the body, now is the time to make that known. You need the counsel of the elders. Now is the time while we stand and sing. Dan.